Welcome to the Cyber Guy Podcast, your source for engaging cyber education, cyber discussions, and a look at current cyber news and trends with retired FBI Special Agent Darren Mott.
Good morning, evening, or afternoon, wherever it is, whenever you're listening to this podcast. I am Darren Mott, retired supervisory special agent for the FBI, host of the Cyber Guy Podcast. And this particular episode is going to be a little different than usual. There's not going to be any intro or outro stuff that I usually talk about. There's going to be the main middle part, which in this case is not necessarily an interview per se, but actually a panel discussion. So I want to thank the company Arctic Wolf for having me moderate a panel of cybersecurity experts at Kane Prime Steakhouse in Nashville last week. The event was put on by Arctic Wolf, sponsored by the companies Cohesity, Cribble, Okta, Sentinel One, and Varonis. And it was five cyber experts, and I asked them a host of different questions. They had a host of different answers. It was a great event. And so Arctic Wolf allowed me to record this for the podcast. So it's going to sound a little different than the normal interviews because it's not in the nice hermetically sealed facility I usually do the podcast at. It was at a steakhouse, a little echo stuff, but I think it'll come across okay. You'll get the gist of it. The panelists were Matt White, a privacy and cybersecurity expert from Baker Donaldson, Margo Weinrob, a cyber practice leader at the Graham Company, Michael Johnson, who's the CISO for MedHost, Patrice Borden, who's a CISO at Community Health Systems, and Lane Sullivan, Deputy CISO at Magellan Health. So this goes about 55 minutes or so. There's a question and answer period, and I hope you enjoy it.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Oops, sorry. Thank you so much for coming. This is not going to amplify my voice. It's for a podcast that we're doing. So very excited to have the panel out here today. It's a really great group of leaders in the room today. And then we've also got moderator Darren Mott, who's retired special agent with the FBI, and the host of his podcast, Cyber Guy. So there you go. And we've got a great set of questions today. I'm going to have the panel introduce themselves really quickly and answer one question, which is the biggest cybersecurity challenge that you're seeing either in the industry today or in your role for your company. And I'll let them introduce themselves. And then we've got some apps on the table for you guys to enjoy, obviously get some drinks going, and then we'll serve dinner around 7:30. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we'll start with Matt.
Hi, I'm Matt White. I'm an attorney with Baker Donaldson, and I do both privacy and cybersecurity work. Probably more than half of my practice now is incident response, and so I sort of come at some of this with that slant. You know, in terms of the biggest risk my clients are facing now, I think it's really twofold. One is dealing with cyber insurance and trying to make sure they have coverage or have relatively affordable coverage. And that is an ongoing challenge. And, you know, I guess a little bit bigger picture, it's really just the evolution of cyber threats right now. Threats are becoming more and more complex, they're becoming more complicated, and the solutions to try to prevent some of those things from happening are becoming complex as well and costly. And so trying to navigate all of that has been an increasing challenge. And then, frankly, we're really going back to, you know, we've been dealing with ransomware for years. We've really started to see a big swing back towards business email compromises and wire frauds. And so it's sort of kind of replaying the old hits in that regard. And so kind of all of that together, I would identify as the biggest risk.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, everyone. My name is Margo Weinrob, and I'm the cyber practice leader at the Graham Company. So we are a risk management consulting and insurance brokerage firm. I would say from my side, really, of that insurance focus, the biggest challenge is keeping up with, as Matt's saying, that threat landscape, but how it's impacting the coverage and trying to make sure we can help organizations find that coverage, but also deal with all of the requirements. Obviously, the big thing that we're seeing is insurance is definitely reactive. What claims we may have seen, they then look at how could this have been prevented, and then now says, now you must have all of those controls. And really balancing, there is only so much money of a budget of how do you focus on what is the insurance spend, and then the risk management and kind of IT needs, and blending those together is a big challenge I'm constantly facing.
Yep. Lane Sullivan, CISO at Magellan Health. I would probably say the biggest challenge is probably knowing everything everywhere. So data, assets, users, because you can't protect it unless you know it. So I'd probably say what they said, and the ground root of that is knowing everything.
I'm Michael Johnson. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for MedHost. I liked his answer, so I guess I got to do something a little bit different. I would say for me, being a managed service provider, as well as, you know, having a developed EHR, it's really finding the common ground between us and our security posture and our client security posture. I would say, you know, identity and access management is a great avenue into that. You know, we certainly, you know, authorize and authenticate people into our system. You know, things like how do we effectively terminate a user without necessarily being plugged into their infrastructure and their HR system and their AD infrastructure. So I would say probably termination of access of our clients is a problem that I've yet to solve that's keeping me up at night.
Hi, Patrice Baudron, CISO at CHS Community Health Systems. I came from the financial industry. I've been at CHS for 10 months. And everything that you guys have said is absolutely correct. I think the biggest challenge that I see in my organization is just culture, understanding what security is and how we are able to enable the business. There's this this idea that security is security's problem. It really isn't. I think that is, and then the other item I would say, the other thing I would say is just resources, getting really good resource, skilled security folks. Now, having said that, the East Coast and West Coast has collapsed, so you're able to go and get those resources a lot, not just Tennessee-based, but everywhere else, which makes it a lot more palatable, and it makes it, it makes it, at least you've got a bigger, you can cast your web a lot, your net a lot bigger. But the resources, what they're asking for is just in some cases ridiculous. So I would say those two things in addition to what this panel has said.
All right, thanks. And my name again is Darren Mott. I am a retired FBI agent. You hear that, you say, why isn't Scott Augenbaum here? If you're from Nashville, you're probably wondering, why is this guy here? Well, Scott is at Black Hat, and so he wanted to say he's sorry he couldn't be here, but he is probably standing next to a Spider-Man guy, a guy in a Spider-Man costume and an exotic dancer holding up a sign that says, please put MFA on your personal stuff. So I've known Scott for almost 20 years. In the FBI, we were referred to as like twins, like the from the movie. I was Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was the Danny DeVito character. So Scott usually does these panels, and unlike Scott, who probably thinks of the questions on his drive over here, I actually wrote some stuff down. So we'll start with cyber insurance as the first topic of conversation here. And as mentioned, this is being recorded for a podcast. You can hear it on my podcast. I'm going to give it to Arctic Wolf to pass on. If you want a copy, an audio copy of this, just let me know, and I'll pass it to you. So from VentureBeat.com, close to 75% of global cyber risk decision makers report that their company experienced at least one cyber attack in the past year. And just 3% of respondents rated their company's cyber hygiene as excellent. Furthermore, recent research puts the average ransom payout at $211,000, which probably is underestimating that. Naturally, to protect themselves, more organizations are investing often significantly in cyber insurance, particularly as cybersecurity breaches, hacks, and ransomware attacks are often not included in traditional policies. So the first question here, and I'll go to Matt as the cyber insurance expert, have we reached a turning point in cyber insurance? If companies don't have an existing policy, will it be harder for them to acquire it as these threats continue to cause issues?
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, question two.
No. The insurance market is tightening dramatically, and it's difficult to get new coverage. It's difficult to get coverage renewed. We are spending more time now with clients and dealing with their insurance than I've ever done at any other point in my career. 5 or 6 years ago, when you went to get a policy or renew a policy, you had to typically answer a pretty short questionnaire. 3 or 4 years before that, you just had to write a check and you got your cyber insurance. Now we're regularly dealing with 18 or 20 page questionnaires that go in detail in terms of what the requirements are and what what protections you may have in place. I've facilitated calls between my clients' IT folks and insurance to make sure that they can understand what's going on. And then there's the low-hanging fruit, right? They're the things that you just have to have now to be able to be insurable. I mean, things like MFA, endpoint protection, phishing testing. I mean, those types of things are really just baseline things you have to have, where going back a few years ago, those were things that were great if you were doing them, but you know, weren't necessarily a requirement. And so, absolutely, it's hard to get insurance now. And if you are not insured yet, it's a hill to climb for sure.
One thing I'll add as we go through this, if you have a question during any of these questions, just pop your hand up and we'll certainly pop in there for that. And I'll probably come up with questions that you guys haven't seen yet. I think you've seen some, we'll see, but I'll come up with some as we go. Next question for Margo along those lines. Are there ways companies can improve their cyber hygiene to make them A, more insurable, and B, lower their premiums?
Lowering your premiums, I'd say, might not be in the cards nowadays. Unfortunately, at the beginning of this year, end of last year, rate increases were minimum 80, kind of going up to 200%. Now we're really at a point where we're seeing more of that 40 to 60 is kind of what we're averaging. That's probably making people's jaws still come to the floor. And the big part of that becomes, if you just got a large increase last year and you had to implement all of these controls, now you're being told you have to do it again this year, what does 2023 look for? What more do you need to do? And at that point, is it worth it? But a lot of the times, the reason why you buy insurance policy is for that kind of second layer of protection. Yes, your organization is going to do all that it can to protect itself, but as Lane said, you only can protect what you know. So you need to have that insurance policy as an additional layer of protection, but you also might have contract requirements that need you to have this insurance policy as well. So thinking about that aspect, it's hard to be proactive in the current marketplace because we're really following what these threat actors are doing. A couple of years ago, it really was that third-party liability. What are the suits you're going to be seeing? Then it became last year ransomware. Matt and I were just talking before this about how business email compromise is the big thing that we're seeing even more so this year, that trying to make sure you're consistently keeping up with those baselines that in the past were nice to see controls as now is need to see. So MFA was something we talked about years ago. No one really had it. Now you must have it. Thinking about privilege access management tools, what are the EDR tools, the XDR tools, all of that, how are you taking care of your employees? Because typically there's always some human error element. So fixing that culture, all of that really plays into that big process of insurance. But knowing it's not just going to be that few pages of applications, every carrier has a different application that they're going to ask for. So it is going to be a long and tedious process that being proactive, trying to starting early. If you know your insurance renewal is October, making sure you've already started that process. You've already engaged with all of the people of your organization for a comprehensive approach.
So you mentioned.
Am I allowed to ask questions?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, please. Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh boy. Here we go. I'm just curious, opinion wise, right? How many organizations utilize the insurance as a first level of defense, first line defense versus second?
I would say I think typically it's second line just because there already is some controls in place. If you have a firewall, you already have one control at a minimum. But I will say we are seeing some organizations say if it's because of their budget, well, we'll just buy more insurance. They might use that as a leverage of, because when we're talking about insurance, it's often the CFO or the risk manager having that conversation. Sometimes the CISO isn't in those board meetings, so they're kind of told after the fact that insurance is your solution.
I think 2 or 3 years ago, it was, for many people, their first line of defense. And I mean, I was in many conversations where the question is, what are you doing for your cyber preparedness? And they would say, well, I have cyber insurance to cover that. I think the reality is the folks that view it that way are no longer insurable. And so, by default, it has become a second line of defense.
So, you mentioned controls. Is there a set of controls that insurance companies want companies to use? If you're in the defense industrial base, CMMC is what's coming your way, and you have to deal with all of that and 800-171 and wherever, whatever level you want to be at. But there's a lot of industries that don't have necessary compliance standards. Obviously, healthcare has HIPAA, and finance has, you know, PCI and all that kind of stuff. What does the insurance companies, what do they use to set controls for their systems to keep them secure? And do they recommend a set of controls for potential insurees that would make them more insurable to the companies?
So I think it's fair to note that no company is safe
Right, sure.
Thinking about, unfortunately, last year there was an insurance company that was impacted by a cyber incident. So knowing that there's really, it's kind of a, not an if, but a when moment for every organization of thinking about how to be protected. So unfortunately, cyber insurance might be that line of defense to help you in the sense of it's not just your budget being hit. But I think the big thing I always think about is human error being a big impact, that if we were all computers and none of us could click on a malicious link, most likely we'd probably be in a safer world.
Wait, I'm not a computer?
Surprise. So I think thinking about that aspect really plays a part into it of fixing your culture, building that up of focus. The amount of times I've heard from our clients, yeah, I thought that was a weird link, but I just needed to keep moving forward, so I sent that invoice and paid it. Or they were giving free lunch, so I wanted to put my name in there. And things of that sort, where what is really that foundation is where I think to go back to, because every organization is susceptible.
Okay, so Lane, this question's for you. So it's all kind of along those lines a little bit, talking about controls and so on. So Twilio and Cloudflare announced within the last few days that they were both victims or attempted victims of an attack that targeted family members at home. So how has the work from home impacted companies' capabilities to secure their networks? Because now the home network is part of the corporate network. So how do you bring all that stuff in, and how do you push those controls down to the corporate network or to your home network?
Yeah, I think impact-wise, massive. And I think that's where my question with the first line versus second line and whether we see changes in the insurance industry is because I think that there is a change. I think that there's a differentiation between a large enterprise, the midline businesses, and small businesses. When you talk about how can they apply controls, when we had COVID and we diversified where our assets were, it's no longer within the core anymore. You're protecting them sitting out. And I think the small to medium-sized businesses have a much tougher time to apply controls to those assets. They don't have the tooling. They don't have the necessary knowledge, the expertise to do that. And it becomes very difficult to manage those things. And in a larger enterprise, you may have the tools and the expertise, but the breadth of the landscape, the threat landscape, becomes larger. And it's harder to know where every asset is. Is it in every closet of people's homes and things like that? Because you'd be surprised how many large enterprises have people that work from home that have multiple assets that they never sent in that they may be using, and they don't really track them anymore. So I think that, there's a huge impact between that with the user weakness there, right? And now they're not on your network, and now they're being targeted. But I think also when we think about the user, the threats that are coming now, we're talking minutes to weaponize. So our responses have to dictate the risk level of what the threat's coming in. And no longer can we look at threats as, you know, critical, high, medium, low. It's in our environment. It's a CVSS score of 10. Okay, that's critical. We can't look at it that way anymore. We have to gauge our risk based on where the data is, where the asset is, what's on there, the users that have access, and things like that.
And last week there was a news article that came out that from the time a new vulnerability is discovered, the bad guys are using that vulnerability within 15 minutes.
That's right.
So that brings us kind of to my next set of questions, which is cyber as a business risk as opposed to not just an IT risk. So CMSWire.com, there was an article and they said, one of the challenges when it comes to so-called cybersecurity risk is in accepting and then applying the idea that cyber is not an IT risk, it's a business risk. So Michael, this one's for you. Do you agree with that assessment?
It can be both. And I think that, you know, risk covers a lot of different areas. It's like saying the word cloud, right? What is the word cloud? I think, you know, a majority of my time is spent with IT, even though I don't report to the IT department. It is really about house cleaning, finding the little things to tweak, to change, to make sure that hygiene is protected. I think I spend a lot of time with process, making sure that we find, you know, what is a defect in a process, readjusting controls, making sure now that it flows correctly. But I would also say the inverse of that is absolutely there can be business risks. You know, I think back to a comment that was just made a few minutes ago. 5, 6, maybe 10 years ago, who had MFA in the room? I can remember having a conversation where it was maybe two honors for physicians to be able to use multi-factor. It was too big of a culture shift. That's a business risk decision. And that's going to require individuals outside of the IT organization, really at the top, to be able to say, no, we have, risk to maintaining, maybe our client relationships. And we've also got security risk in which we, being in healthcare, have a responsibility for our individual users that are using our healthcare system. And we've got to weigh it this way now. So what becomes that tipping point? And I think as a CISO, you've got to do both, right? You've got to be able to be focused in the IT organization and focused on IT risk, but you've also got to be able to recognize that certain conversations are executive conversations and have the ability to go talk to them and change the culture of the company itself. And you talked a lot about culture, Patrice.
Yeah, Patrice, then talking culture will kind of lead to this question. So do you think the C-suite, or at least executives, are starting to see cyber more as an investment versus a cost, or are they still looking at it as a cost? Because it is obviously a cost, but should they look at it as both an investment and a cost?
Yeah, just to add to your question, to the answer you gave, I think everybody's aware of security, cyber. When you work in an organization, everybody should be fiscally responsible. Do you all agree? Well, why can't we have people that have security stewards across the organization? I think that's the culture that we need to get to. Not just security awareness, but being stewards of security. Coming back to that question on whether it's an investment or cost center, obviously there's a lot of cost involved, but it can be an investment. I'll answer the question two ways. In my previous company, we were a financial and insurance company, one of the Fortune 100 companies. Cybersecurity actually became a huge competitive advantage. When you're out there trying to sell public life insurance, if you don't have a cyber program, the government wants, these government organizations, they won't even bother with you. Now, we're not talking millions of dollars of contracts, we're talking billions. So one state of California, one contract is over $2 million that you can get. What were they looking at? Your cyber program. So when we went on the road, they had me go with them so I could speak on our cyber program. And that's a lot of what the differentiator was. So yes, it can be an investment. It depends on your business model, it depends on your business. In the healthcare, I'm still trying to figure that out, quite honestly. But in the healthcare, there is cybersecurity, no matter which industry you're in, cybersecurity is a portion of your IT expense. I think you all agree to that. When do we get involved in the defects? After it's gone to productions, we try to fix these security defects. Not before, so we're spending a lot of time, and we all know that your cost is about 75% of your IT cost after it's gone to production. We should be thinking about doing that. So I think it comes down to a cost. If you can understand your defects, your security defects before the time, and you reduce the cost afterwards, it makes financial sense. You're reducing your cost, you're reducing your IT expense. Investors are gonna be happy with that. So I think that's maybe one way to look at that. Just one of my thoughts, at least. I think there's other ways. Cyber insurance, another very good example. If you've got a really good risk posture, a really good program, you're going to be insurable at a really favorable rate. And that's another way that I think you can help with that.
I would add that it's always going to be a cost until you have an incident.
Once I was
you
just going to say that.
It's the best investment you ever had.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. The best meme is the one where the guy's counting pennies and it says cybersecurity budget before the breach. And then after the breach, he's got $100 bills in front of him, stuff like that. So this is open to anybody can answer this one. How can CISOs and CIOs and the people in this room help their executives come to the same conclusion that cybersecurity necessarily needs to be more of an investment in addition to the cost? How do you bridge that C-suite gap and get them to believe?
I'll say from the business side, from oftentimes talking to the CFOs and the risk managers, they're sometimes not having the conversations with the CISOs and the CTOs and the CIOs. So for them, they think that it just is, this is the security budget. That's all they have. They can make it work, not realizing how much technology changes, how often they need to be keeping up with it and prioritizing it. They'll buy new autos every couple of years because that's what they need for their business, but they're not thinking about what do they need to consistently keep up with the threat landscape and education for them, yeah, my side.
I think everyone from the executive level down for a long time has realized that cybersecurity is a real risk. The difference was in the past, it was just sort of looked at as, well, it's a risk, but IT is going to fix it. And that was the end. And I think, you know, in the wake of, you know, certainly some of the widely publicized events over the last 18 months, I think the conversations are starting, right? I mean, after Colonial Pipeline, I had more executives calling me asking about these things than CISOs calling me about these things. And I think that has started to shift the environment. I think certainly as insurance costs have risen, it's starting to, you know, make CFOs pay a lot more attention to, well, why is cyber insurance so expensive now? And then that gets you into the controls. I think also from a regulatory standpoint, we're starting to see more regulations that are requiring executive and board oversight over cybersecurity programs specifically. And so we saw the amendments to the GLBA safeguard rules that applies to certain financial institutions that now have to have that director level checks on the program, or the SEC's recent proposal on cybersecurity rules that they're requiring, you know, for investment companies that there be fund oversight by the board of directors. And so I think that the temperature is starting to change to require that higher level oversight and involvement in making those decisions to alleviate some of the burden from only being on IT to being on the executive level as well. And in terms of how do you facilitate that, you know, if your executives, your boards aren't on in that place yet, I think just starting to familiarize yourself with some of those requirements that are coming out that are going to, from a regulatory perspective, require them to pay attention. And being able to have those discussions and say, look, I mean, this isn't just me asking for more money. This is, you know, these new laws and regulations require you to pay attention to this.
Yeah, I think being as a CISO or CIO, either one, and sometimes in the small organizations, they double up, right, or triple up or whatever. If you are not sitting with the other executives on a regular cadence, then you're just in a closet somewhere doing your own thing. If it's not something that you can have a conversation with them about on a regular schedule, they're not going to reach out. They're not going to be well informed. And I think having that that cadence with the influence without authority, I think, is really the trying to put that in front of them, right? I think it goes back to the business risk question, which is most of the time it would depend on the organization or where they're at, whether it's a business risk or not. Except when they have a security incident, very quickly becomes a business risk, and all the board members would absolutely agree with that, the second after ransomware incident. Mm. So I would say that, yes, and I think that we're seeing more laws, regulatory, coming out from the states. Mm-hmm. Indiana, Kentucky, New York, California, the new amendments with the CPRA, more data privacy is being driven from the state level, and I think that changes how we operate, and those laws are going to drive customers to make certain requirements, the insurance makes certain requirements. Now the executives say, and I can quote one from this last month in my meeting, this is all I talk about with my customers now. It's changing the way that we do business.
So this is going to be a loaded question. I'll give it to Michael.
Can I answer that last one?
Oh, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
I've got a little bit different answer to this. So, especially in our business, being a managed service provider, but I think this is consistent across the board. One of the most important pillars is uptime, right? So imagine if everybody in this room was a user on a network, and everybody in this room, we granted domain admin. Everybody's got rights to change whatever they want to change in the environment.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I you know what? It just works. Just give it out like
trust
candy.
Me, just like that.
Yeah, you're good. I trust you. How long before one of us makes a stupid change? How long, right? So if you want to provide value to executives, right, I think one of the key pillars for InfoSec is it's a quality function. If we do the little things right, if we clean up the problems, if we make sure the configurations are good, if we're able to look at logs and identify problems, maybe even proactively. But if we just take away domain admin from everybody, you know, we take away server admin rights, How effective are we at reducing the inappropriate problems, the oops, you know, the junior admin who's got, you know, 6 months in InfoSec because we can't find quality resources, makes a mistake and brings the network down. So when I think about what my job is, most importantly across, you know, MedHost, it really is, how do I provide quality by doing the little things right that IT misses because they're too focused sometimes on getting a product completed to ensure that our clients remain up. And if I do those things right, then cyber insurance becomes a little bit easier when I get that 14-page questionnaire once a year that keeps getting bigger and more complex.
So here's my loaded question. It's open to anybody who wants to jump on the landmine first. So we talked about laws and regulations. Do we think that the government is the way that's going to fix all of this? Because you saw the executive order from 2000 and last year. You've seen the new couple ones this year. You've seen all this stuff about, hey, we're going to push down zero trust mandates and all this other stuff. Is that going to cause bigger burdens, or is that going to just people make it ignore? Because GDPR seemed to have worked from a somewhat try to protect the stuff information in Europe. Do you see any kind of that GDPR stuff coming this way? We're not going to get into politics of whether we have the right government to put that together, but is government here to fix our problems?
If it's a simple no, we can go to the next question.
I mean, government or insurers, right? I mean, we've been talking about cyber insurance. I mean, they're moving down the exact same path. How do they kind of legislate from afar and ensure that, in their view, that companies, whether they're small, medium, or large, are doing the little things right? The challenge they've got is they really don't know the business. And, I equate some of this to, you know, maybe vendor security risk programs. We've all tried to figure out how to do vendor security risk and ask the right questions to a different company, and they all come out with, you know, once again, these kind of 15-page, you know, question sets. And so, we really haven't figured out how to, whether it's the government, whether it's insurers, whether it's ourselves, be able to assess risk for a different company without really understanding what that company does and how they function. What Patrice might find as an acceptable risk that he has to have in order to run his business effectively might be far different than what I need in order to run mine. And I think that there has to be more conversations, one-on-one conversations on what we've accepted and how we run that in order for it to be effective. So no, I don't think the government can do a great job at that.
How many of you at your company has cybersecurity as the number one threat? None? No, how many have actually declared cybersecurity as your number one threat at your company? None.
We have.
You have?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, you have to have the conversation very differently. If at the top of the house they don't believe that cybersecurity is the top threat for the company, it's going to be a lot more difficult. Government's not going to help. Government will help, carrot and stick with compliance. Sure, insurance will help, but at the end of the day, you've got to take responsibility as well. As a CISO, I just finished reading a book called Extreme Ownership. If you haven't read it, it's a pretty good book. But Extreme Ownership talks about us taking that ownership. And I think the healthcare industry, at least where I come, what I've seen is, it's the 12th year that this industry has had the highest number of breach, yet cybersecurity is not the number one threat. And I find that kind of extraordinary. So what do I think we can do? It's building consensus. And building consensus by first defining what cyber resiliency means to your stakeholders. What does it mean to them? Not what it means to you from cybersecurity. They pay the CISO to be that expert, right? But what we got to figure out is, what does it mean to them? And I think what you need to do, Matt said something really interesting just now. We can help facilitate the conversation to figure out what it means to them. And then let them be the deciders on that. Let's get their collective wisdom on what that should be for the company. And I think that's something that, as an IT person, as a security person, we have ownership of. And we should be thinking about it that way. And I think that regulators and all that, yeah, sure, it's going to help. But I think that's where we have a lot of stake and a lot of responsibility that we got to take ownership on.
The question was, can the government help drive change or something like that? I'm going to have to take the political aspect out of it, completely. So I'm not, there's nothing political in this, right?
Right.
Bo knows me enough to say, okay.
I guess can mandated requirements drive solutions?
I actually think that it's the only way that businesses understand their contractual obligations. When they look at their bottom line, they look at how do I make money in this business? And if they can get around it, most organizations will. I think that a lot of the change we've seen in our industry has come from the regulatory bodies. Or
ransomware.
Ransomware. However, I think that a lot of the regulations we've seen have been in direct relation to a lot of the incidents we see now. But it comes down to, do organization have the proper processes and people to identify data and protect it, classify and know what they have and protect it? The data privacy rules help outline what's required for that. And I think without that, businesses would probably not, whether they got hit with ransomware or not, they probably wouldn't react.
I'll add, for thinking about the government getting involved or insurance getting involved, it really is kind of a work for everyone, because what we've seen from ransomware is really just OFAC saying you can't pay someone from an OFAC sanctioned country. But no one's saying you can't pay a ransom at all, or it's excluded from the cyber insurance policy, the payment, or only $50,000 is the max you can pay for a ransomware, because I think everyone's treading a little lightly of what is the control we can put in place to improve security, but also not debilitate an organization. If paying a ransom is the only way an organization's gonna continue operating, I don't think the government wants to say, no, we're not doing
it. I think the OFAC thing, I think, is almost a red herring out there from the government, because all they've restricted is Bitcoin addresses. Correct. All right, the bad guy looks at it, oh, that's my Bitcoin address. Well, I better get a new one, because it's gonna take me a year before this new one gets back on the list. So right. The OFAC thing is,
It shows
that they care, right? Exactly.
So they did a good job. Like I said, I took politics out of my answer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and you make the good point. Well, so see, everybody know what? Does anyone not know what CMMC is? Cybersecurity and Maturity Model Certification by the DoD. So that kind of shows where a government entity, the Department of Defense, can enforce a compliance regulation for businesses who want to do business with them. If you don't get certified, then you're not doing business with the government. So, I mean, that can work. And actually, for what they're trying to do, I think it's a good thing, because you should have that security hygiene.
Well, but I think there's a difference, right? Can it solve the problem, right?
Yeah.
You know, does that solve the problem or not? You know,
it won't. It won't solve it.
But I think one thing the government can do is it can raise the minimum standards.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think CMMC is a good example of that, where once implemented, you know, we'll start to see some baseline standards. You know, we not at the federal level, certainly the state level, we've seen that on the privacy side quite a bit, right? And they're setting the standards for, you know, what consumers can expect, you know, to receive about or for their data. And so I think that's kind of the approach that I think is most likely, if anything, to go through, is some minimum standards. But, you know, where we are now with the sectoral approach that we've just lived with forever, I mean, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. And so I think we're going to continue to see sort of industry-specific standards evolve. And I hope that we'll see some of those minimum baselines. But, you know, is it going to fix the problem? No, is the answer. But it may help.
So let's talk threats. So there's a whole structure of threats, from script kiddies all the way up to your nation state, PLA, Russian FSB actors. Which ones are you most concerned with? Is it the criminal actors that are doing largely the ransomware business email compromise? Is it the nation state guys who are targeting for IP and counterintelligence related type of theft? What's as you look through the threat spectrum, what's your biggest concern? We'll start down here with Patrice. Let me rephrase this. And can you isolate it that way, or do you have to look through the broad spectrum and then figure out here's the one I want to deal with, and worry about these other ones later.
That makes sense.
In other words, how do you list your threats? Because if you look at the threats, depending on what you have, there's a lot of different actors that could be targeting your information, either for intellectual property theft with China, could be for financial gains, could be to use your network to launch attacks against someone else. How does a company, what do they got to do to start looking through that?
I think, if you look at my industry, the healthcare industry, ransomware has obviously been pretty ripe. VEC definitely now. So it's looking at that and seeing what is, based on your risk posture, where are you most vulnerable, and which actors are going to be interested in, are they interested in intellectual property, state nation? Are they going to be interested in making some quick money, maybe ransomware? So I think it depends on that, and I will start to that, and definitely look at understanding your risk posture, using something like the MITRE attack, and then understand what your vulnerabilities are.
Do any of you use threat intelligence streams?
Oh, yeah.
Which ones are good?
We have actually multiple. So we've built out threat intel as a focal point for us, built into our detection engineering. So we look at daily, hourly, down to the minute, different threats that we see out in the industry, but also internally. So building out use cases to protect against those. But risk management is huge in that, because you have to identify... each organization is different, right? So they're going to see, there's not a lot of organizations that are going to be able to build out a detection threat team, right? They have to rely on what's going to be coming at them now. What you should be most worried about is the threat actors that can get in and get out that you don't even know about.
Yeah. Right? If I go back to your kind of previous question and blend it with Lane's answer, I would say I don't care. I really don't care. I don't care who's attacking. I care about the methodology, right? And if you look at the methodology, whether it's Eastern European criminal elements or nation state attackers, they're really starting to blend in how they proceed through a network. Anybody see Cisco got compromised and they released a brief yesterday? By the way, kudos to Cisco, right?
Yes.
That takes an amazing amount of class and gosh courage.
Well, but hold on. They did say they didn't lose any data, and then the actor said, "Here is the data I took."
Yeah, but even then, think about anybody who's been through a breach, right? You've got lawyers. The standard protocol is you go hire external counsel. You get external counsel to wrap an IR provider inside of a legal wrapper, so that you can say like, yeah, they did a job. For Cisco to come out and say, here were the tactics and the elements that an attacker went through our network and had success, and to say they compromised our Active Directory infrastructure, wow. I mean, I was shocked.
And the speed at which we can transfer that information is the speed at which we can protect everybody else.
If you want to see the textbook way in which an attacker moves through a network, that Cisco document, the TTPs, were exactly it, right? It's initial foothold, it's privilege escalation, it's lateral movement, it's take the SAM and all the user accounts, it's covering a little bit of tracks, it's masking as a user, and then you start to get to maintain persistence and exfiltrate data. So it, as a company, if we focus on all those individual controls, all those, it really starts to feel like a project plan with milestones and dependencies. And so when I think about, how I would build a security program from scratch, I think about how do I try to defeat each milestone? So it's almost like a reverse project plan. And from there, I start to care a lot less about who. And I care a lot more about how to move through and whether I have those effective controls at each individual milestone.
So going down the line, we'll start with Matt. What is the, so 5 years, well, not even 5 years, next year, what threats coming down the pike that you're most, that keeps you up at night or makes you think, this is going to keep me up at night when it hits?
So, I think that we're going to continue to see an increase in the number of business email compromises. I don't know that I would say that keeps me up, because I think we know.
Do you think the methodology will change? Do you think there'll be new ways to do it? Or is it, I mean, I guess if it works, why would you change
it? Yeah, I mean, you know, we're going to see the same sort of things. I mean, your standard phishing email continues to work. And so I think we'll continue to see that. I think the thing that's most disconcerting to me, I think, is the continued development is ransomware as a service. And so as we continue to see more and more individuals or spinoffs from some of the established threat actor groups proliferate ransomware attacks, I think the unpredictability that comes with that and the effects that come with that are really starting to hit home. And I think we're going to see that continue to escalate over the next at least year, if not more. And the unpredictability that that brings into the space, I think, is a real risk.
I think about all the different privacy regulations that are going to continue to change for every state, and how organizations are going to have to balance that of where do they want to continue to operate or expand into? How do they maintain compliance or enough or mask it if they need to? And that's where I think we're just going to continue to see more of those insurance claims on that side. We really see a lot of that first party incident response to a ransomware attack to a business email compromise. But what happens when the attorney generals are bringing suits as well from every single state? I think that's where we're going to keep seeing these insurance claims continue to grow, and then the premiums continue to rise, and the difficulty that then translates to organizations.
I think that in the next year, the threats we see targeted to mobile devices is going to exponentially increase. So ransomware, yes. I think the BEC, yes. However, we've seen a switch from targeted email to targeted texting. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of that in the last 6 to 12 months increase. And so user awareness is massively huge. But I do think that, you know, look at the personal devices, the QNAP device that's been targeted multiple times for ransomware. But I think that the mobile devices, you're going to be getting links in texting and things that people will open up. It will compromise the phones, and I think it's out there now. I think that we're just now beginning to understand security on mobile devices. I mean, how many organizations right now can properly say they secure mobile devices, and yet they're used to access corporate data?
Not only use, you're almost required in some to put their data on your phone.
That's correct.
So I'm going to go with an opposite answer again. Like, I don't see it changing. I don't see really anything changing in 5 years, and I'll tell you why, right? I mean, every organization has one common element. It's people. We all have people. We've all been doing phishing testing now for, gosh, 10 years. How effective has that been? Anybody killing it? Anybody have a clean organization? So, you know, I think it's going to take a fundamental shift in how people operate in order for there to be a fundamental shift in how people attack. How many organizations have really complex passwords? How many people are still doing like the 8 characters, 3 out of 4, rotate 90 days, the NIST guidance from 1975? You know, that was the year I was born, right? Patrice is a lot younger. He's like 29. You know, if you've got rainbow tables, you've got breach data dating back for 10, 15 years in which you have pre-computed hashes sitting out there, and I can just kind of random, like, we all know what people do, right? On the 91st day, they got to change their password, they iterate it by 1, right? You know, the E becomes a 3, the 1 becomes an exclamation point. People are predictable, and until we are able to create a better security model in which people aren't predictable, then attackers are going to continue to take the easy money on the table. And so you know, for us, you know, I've really worked hard at trying to ensure that people have password safes. The minimum password at MedHost is 16 characters. If we crack passwords routinely, if you fail a password crack, then I start randomizing your password, putting it in a safe. And it's trying to educate those people that you don't have to use a password, right? You could, if you got a Windows computer, you can fire it up. You can use Windows Hello. You can have facial recognition. You're logged in. It takes the password, changes it inside the TPM. It's a one-time use. It doesn't help for lateral movement. Then you can use a password safe to be able to check out a password to be able to apply for applications. Effectively, we can start to eliminate the password, which is really the problem, right? Lateral movement always involves password compromise, elevation of that password to a service account. Somebody left that service account with domain admin rights. Poof, I got your AD infrastructure. I have the keys and I'm off to the databases. So how do we shift that user behavior? And then you'll see an attacker shift their paradigm.
You know, I think attackers are lazy. They want to get in and get out the quickest way possible. And I think, you know, why would they go through a complicated channel when they can get in through a very easy? And so I think credentials, compromise of credentials is still going to be, is going to continue. I mean, depending on what articles you read, 80 to 90% of breaches or incidences are as a result of compromised credentials. But I do think, though, there's new avenues that are opening up for them that aren't secure. APIs, I think, is something that I'm concerned about, and I think the industry should be. I think medical devices is another one. There's a footprint there that it's alarmingly quite large, at least in the healthcare industry. So those are things. I think as artificial intelligence is improving, it's going to become another tool for them to use. And so we better get on top of that and use artificial intelligence to defend against them before they figure it out. So those are just some of the things that, in addition to what you guys have said.
All right, now we're going to open up for anybody who has questions for the panel. Come on.
Let's go, Bob.
There you go. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Bob. My name is Bob. Going back to earlier in the presentation in terms of cyber insurance capabilities, what is the number one thing that an IT or a security firm organization can do to reduce their cyber liability, their cyber insurance costs? Domain admin is one of those that we brought up, Michael. Is that a significant factor? But I've got an organization with 400 IT personnel, with security, IT folks. I'm going to have 200 people who warrant the access to domain admin.
No, not 200, Bob. What have you done, Bob?
What are these 200 people doing with DA?
What's the number one thing that we can do?
Yeah, stop.
What are you doing, Bob? I have 200.
Insurance costs. Or the organization?
I would say at this point, I don't think it's just one anymore. That minimum baseline of what you need to be insurable is MFA, EDR, employee training, disabling local admin, attested incident response plan, network segmentation, strong backups. Those are the minimums they're just asking for. And that's what they say. This is what you need to have. And it's hundreds of carriers, and more than 100 insurance carriers are consistently writing insurance, and they all care and prioritize that list a little bit.
Well, let me rephrase it then. Does the number of domain admins impact insurance costs?
Yes, and service accounts in the domain admin group also is a big thing we're seeing carriers.
It's not the number. It would be the process at which you secure them. You can have 1,000 of them, but if you secure them correctly, who cares?
But if you secured them correctly, they wouldn't be domain admins.
Well, I agree, but I guess that's what I'm saying. If you secure them correctly, who cares?
Well, that comes back to zero trust. Can you absolutely guarantee that person who is leveraging that credential is who they say they are?
I think, you know, MFA certainly supports that, right? So are there edge conditions where MFA can be defeated? Certainly, you know, Evil Genix 2. And
99%.
However, right? I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of things that you can do with a well-constructed privileged access management system. You know, you've got an employee using one set of credentials. They're checking out a second set of credentials. They're providing a business justification for that checkout. That can be instantaneously reviewed by someone to say, does that make sense? You limit it to, you know, only a very small number, right? So, you know, Bob Fuller doesn't have domain admin. We have an account that Bob Fuller can then access. If I looked at my 14-page questionnaire from my cyber insurance that I've been living through, sorry, I, I've got a little trauma right now.
PTSD.
PTSD. What they would say is, you know, Microsoft best practices, privileged access, workstation, pause, privileged services manager where they can't actually see the password, but multi-factor on every use, rotate the password, after each use or a very small period of time.
Have we dealt with that much lately?
Yeah.
Just-in-time privilege grant.
Yeah, absolutely. In a perfect world, right, if you could have the panacea, which hasn't happened yet, right, you'd have ServiceNow, and you would have a change request, and that change request would be approved by somebody in executive management, and that would grant you access in which somebody could aggregate and correlate logs on the back end to say, did he actually do what he said he was going to do with the CR? That is possible to be built. I haven't seen it yet.
Actually, take one step back. Provision user JIT so that the user store with identity governance is within a central repository where it provisions users' entitlements and all within, right?
And then rotating that hash, right? I mean, if you talk about, the credential stored where it shouldn't be, if you never use a domain admin on a workstation, then you can't get domain admin from a workstation, right? If you never use domain admin on a server, then you can't get...
That's clear, right? That's clear. We've got to get rid of password.
So you can reboot a machine, you can change password. Those are the two ways to clear a token once the token's been touched, right? So if I'm a domain admin, and kind of an analogy, and I go touch Joey, and Joey's a workstation, Joey now is domain admin, right? If you go touch that workstation, you're going to be root, and you can get it. So
why you got to get rid of the passwords.
What a PAM does is it allows you to constantly refresh that password, which breaks having a session inside of a network, which allows you to be able to protect domain admin. I'm monopolizing, so I'm going to shut up now. I'm passionate about this. This is my fun space, so
yes.
I'll be quiet.
Michael and I have a history.
That was a softball, Hugh. I'll throw another one over
right.
there. I'm curious because you said something that piqued my interest in network segmentation. Mm-hmm. Like we talk about identifying data, how do you protect that data, how do you segment that data, user access, absolutely governance around identity. But how many people really implement network segmentation appropriately? Raise your hand.
I think the big thing also is recognizing when you're filling out insurance questionnaire, it's an insurance person reviewing it.
Yeah.
So the question is, do you have network segmentation by function or geography?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the question. And if you can answer that,
you have a
yes,
DMZ and you have a production
they're
network.
They're not asking further, and that's where oftentimes
I got that
doing
question.
It really well is where it's tough to then kind of go further. And until we keep pushing those questions further, we're only going to ever still need to have a lot more way to go.
And the question would be, do you properly segment the network to reduce the risk based on the data classification where it stores?
Right. Or how? Everything right now is yes or no, and it's a black and white answer, but how can we make these be open-ended questions that you really need to answer and tell your story, advocate for yourself?
I think the answer to the question, what do you need to do to reduce your insurance? I mean, none of it's rocket science. I mean, the insurance companies they're learning this along with companies at the same time, and so the insurance questions aren't specific or detailed enough. I mean, they're specific and detailed, but not enough to really get into the weeds that we're talking about. It's those baseline things that they're now requiring you and expecting you to have. None of it's rocket science. It's just implementing all of those to be able to say yes to everything on the checklist.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to have food coming out soon, so round of applause. How awesome.
So once again, I want to thank Arctic Wolf for having me in Nashville last week to moderate that particular panel. And thank you for all the panelists for agreeing to sit in front of microphones for an hour and answer my host of variety of questions. Next week, we will have an episode with some moms here local in my neighborhood. I'm going to talk to them about what their biggest fears are when it comes to protecting their kids online. So look for that hopefully a little later coming up this week. Also, if you have friends and family members that aren't the have a misunderstanding or don't quite understand this whole cyber thing, feel free to refer them to my other podcast, the Get Cyber Smart podcast, available on all of your normal podcast providers. As always, I want to thank you for listening. If you have any questions or thoughts or comments on the podcast, feel free to hit me up, Darren@thecyberguy.com, cyber spelled C-Y-B-U-R. Know that knowledge is protection. As you go through your week, make sure you assess understand the threats targeting you, assess your risk online, and then proceed wisely. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you again soon.